Welcome to Environmental Voices Rising, Women at the Mic, where you can step into the world of environmental advocacy and innovation. I'm your host, Michael Crawford Zimring, and I'm inviting you to join us. In each episode of our podcast, we amplify the voices of environmental leadership from a distinct perspective. From grassroots organization, groundbreaking research, to bold activism in courts, local government, and industry, each episode celebrates the diverse voices of fearless and creative women and girls who are shaping a sustainable and equitable future. These women believe in a future where innovative solutions and an unwavering commitment to social justice and a healthier planet is available for all. We invite you to join us, listen to today's episode, be inspired and motivated to find your own voice. My guest today is Stacy James, co-founder, CEO, and driving force behind Dazzle Africa, an organization that takes guests on safaris in Africa. Dazzle Africa is also committed to the support and empowerment of the local community in Zambia, the protection of African wildlife, and the education of local youth. Dazzle Africa is pioneering a new way of bringing awareness to the preservation and conservation of wildlife and building community resources for that support. Stacy, welcome to Environmental Voices Rising, Women at the Mic. It's so nice to see you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Great. Could you start us off with the story of how you started Dazzle Africa and the story of the elephants walking through the Mufui Lodge in Zambia?
Sure. My mother had sent me a video years before 2011, and it was of elephants walking, wild elephants walking through a lodge in Zambia to eat the ripened mangoes from a tree in the back of the lodge. The funny thing is that there are other ways to get to the tree, so they don't have to walk through reception of this lodge to be able to get to the mangoes, yet they do. It's just funny. And so she had sent me that video years before, and it was in the back somewhere of my memory of wanting to go there at some point. And then after a couple of years after 2008, I was ready for a refresh, and so chose to go to Zambia and see the elephants walk through the lodge. Initially, the elephants were the driving force because I just thought, how cool is that? It was not contrived. They were wild. Nobody was forcing them to do anything.
That description is so lovely. I mean, I like the wording that you used. The elephants actually choose to walk through the lobby. They don't have to go that way. So you decided to go to Zambia, and I know you went with some friends. So how did you get this group together to just go?
I joke around, it was easier to get people to go on that trip than it was to organize a movie. it was just one of those serendipitous times where everybody, you know, I said, I'm going to go. Does anybody want to come with me? My cousin at the time was having her 40th birthday. She said, I want to go. I mentioned it to somebody else. Somebody else overheard me. And before you know it, there's six women. Not all of us were connected before the trip. I knew just a couple of people, and then a couple of the other women invited others. So it was a slightly eclectic group of six of us from the United States. And then we all met for the first time in Zambia. So, yeah.
So you had this amazing experience, but instead of just going home and having wonderful memories, you decided that you wanted to go back and connect with the local community and find some way to give back. And I think one of your first projects had to do with water. Could you tell us what it's like to bring water to a community in Africa, and specifically Mufui? Because it's not something that we in the West can easily think about, like walking, how many hours and miles that you might have to walk just to get water.
So, I mean, one of the things we did decide collectively, I mean, we were so filled up with the generosity and love and kindness of the people who lived in this area that we wanted to do a little something to be able to be in partnership. And What I will say is that from the beginning, our goal was never to go in and think that we knew best. Quite contrary. We got there and we're like, oh gosh, they sure have a lot of things figured out. And so, but we did see areas where we could partner, you know, they give us, we give them. So we made that part of our mission from the beginning, that we would listen to partners on the ground about what kinds of things were needed. Water is such a, you know, in the West, I feel like we are just so lucky to, even if the water quality isn't the best, which is a whole other topic, but we are so lucky that we have the accessibility of water here in the United States, especially. So we, you know, wake up in the morning, and I think just unconsciously, we live in Kansas right now. I got up in the morning, went out to the barn, gave the chickens fresh water. You know, it's like brush my teeth. There's all these different things that we do unconsciously where we use water continuously. And most of the water that we use is acceptable in the U.S. But in these rural areas of different places all over the world, this is just one specific example and one tiny part of our world. But in many places in rural Zambia, there is not accessibility to not only clean water, just water. So you'll have mostly women and young girls walking down to the river or digging holes in the sand or walking a long distance to go to, could be another borehole somewhere in the area. But it takes a lot of time. Sometimes it's dangerous. It's dangerous because of wild animals sometimes. It's dangerous because of people sometimes. It's dangerous because of the horrendous quality of lack of quality of water, because you'll have animals drinking and eating and defecating in the same place that you have people drawing water. So it's dangerous. And it's something that is usually, unless you are traveling to those places where you, you know, you see the communities, it's so easy not to even think about it, or it's not on our radar typically. So over the years, we partnered with the same company that owns Mafui Lodge, the Bush Camp Company, and we have partnered with them this year. With their partnership and some matching programs, we'll have partnered for 80, I think it's 82 or 83 boreholes.
And that's a well. A borehole is like a well, right?
It is. It's like a deep drilled well. So a lot of times you'll hear people talk about, usually if it's a well, it's a shallow well where they draw water, which is oftentimes the water gets contaminated from different things. So this is a, like a, if you were to imagine like a probably a massive like concrete truck like that size, and they have a literal drill that boreholes down. So yeah, those boreholes last approximately 20 years, supply approximately 300 people a day with clean water. And they're different in every country. I know that it depends on sort of the soil, and some boreholes are more expensive or less expensive in different areas around the world. Ours are approximately $5,500. And that is pennies a day for clean water.
So $5,500 is an expense, but it's doable. And on the business end, the safaris, you're using the safaris to help finance a lot of these community projects because you are a nonprofit, which is really interesting that you are running a safari business that is not for profit, and you're using financing to circle back and partner with the local communities. Tell us about the safaris.
So we are a 501c3. We're based in Nevada. The safari actually came first. So 2012 was our very first safari. We did a yoga performing arts safari, actually, because why not?
Why not?
We had so much fun. And that kicked off our sort of history with safaris in 2012. But our safaris are one form, and I think one of our best, actually, one of the best ways that we can treat people to one of their bucket list items of having an incredible luxury safari that also gets to see behind the scenes of what's happening. So we don't keep them excluded from the community. We introduce them to the community and really have conversations and help see what life is like, what it takes to protect the animals in the area, what education looks like and why that's important. And then we also take them to our boreholes so they can see and learn about water if they would like to. But safaris, I think, are because people fall in love with yourself again. You know, you get grounded, you feel closer to the earth, I think. And people just automatically, like the shoulders drop, more smiles on the faces. It's just a form of relaxation that we don't have as much in our daily lives, I think. You know, and you're next to ancient animals, you know, you're next to elephants and lions and different species, that there's like this awe and wonder that rises up in people.
Yeah, no, for sure. I've been on safari and I know exactly what you're talking about. It's like such a heart-opening encounter, you know, with these animals to be with, and you can actually feel the land, and the people usually are just like amazing. They are so open and generous.
Where did you go, Michael?
Kruger.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Nice. So you started with a yoga safari. That's pretty creative. So what kind of safaris do you have now?
We host all sorts of different types of safaris. So we host, women's safaris, classic safaris. I'm thinking about introducing a plant medicine safari, not ingesting plant medicine necessarily, but just learning about plants and the medicinal properties. So all different kinds. It could be adventure safaris, more relaxing. We offer all sorts of different kinds of safaris.
Great. So, but more than the safaris themselves, you have a larger vision, and it's connected to the water project and education and wildlife preservation. So I would just, can you just give us, what's your big vision picture? I mean, it's pretty big. I'm impressed. When I look at your website, I'm impressed with the big vision that you have. So.
Yeah. My big vision for the safari world is that we sort of pop the bubble of the safari world in the sense that it's more integrated into understanding who the people are, who you're safaring beside, who lives in the community, getting to know the local cultures more, and seeing the impact left in the community to be a very positive one. My vision, though, for overall is that we have a pristine model that positively benefits everyone, the wildlife, the safari community, of course, the people living in the community beside the parks. And so it's a model that works for everyone. And that is a bigger vision that I have in terms of the people thriving, the wildlife thriving, the planet thriving, you know, businesses thriving so people can support themselves. And there are species that have been decimated by humans in various areas. In this particular area, rhinoceros were poached out of the South Huangwa National Park, where we do quite a few of our safaris, in the 80s. And it would be great to be able to just overall for not only Zambia, but other places to have enough collaboration with the communities and protection for the entire park so that species can start thriving again and be reintroduced where it's appropriate into different parks. So I see a thriving Africa.
Thriving Africa. Yes. I've noticed like your conservation effort is really large and inclusive. You have like education, you're supporting students, you're training, you have a veterinarian, you have surveillance, and you're training scouts, all kinds of. So maybe let's just start with the education. How are you supporting like the students? Because is it still true that like in Zambia, education is only available through the 7th grade, and after that, the students and their families are responsible for taking exams and paying fees?
There's different levels in Zambia for which level the student is at, but the biggest gap in general is college. It's tertiary. So maybe the kids are making it all the way through high school. Maybe they have good scores. It's next to impossible for families to be able to pay for a college education for one of their kids, let alone more than that. So early on, we were told by the community that college was the biggest gap. And so that is where we have focused our efforts pretty much from the beginning. Every once in a while, in the beginning, we would take on a student who wasn't college. But at this point, we have sponsored a little over 40 students that have gone on to higher education. And our primary goal is that the students that we are sponsoring become leaders in their community. So it could be that they are lawyers, it could be teachers, but we have a very heavy focus for leadership in science. And so one of our conservation partners, Ambient Carnivore Program, we partner with them often for students who are going to school to be, could be veterinarians, but more than likely they're biologists, resource management, things like that. So I think one thing collectively with Conservation South Wongwa and Zambian Carnivore Program, our two main conservation partners, is that they are wanting to have a Zambian-led strong leadership sense within all of their employees that are, you know, coming up through the organization. And so we partner with them quite often for leadership in science to help those students. Our goal is that the future is Zambian. And we have a strong female effort as well. And it's really, really neat to see young women in science and conservation in Zambia.
That's exciting. So are they coming back and working close to home in their communities?
Yeah, I mean, I would say most of them want to. So as long as they can be employed in the community, absolutely. We have one student in the U.S. She's at Catawba College in North Carolina. All of the other students, there's one graduate student in Sweden that we're just partnering on for his last year, and everyone else is in Zambia. But I think they love where they come from, and I think they're super proud to go back and work within their organizations. So.
No, that's wonderful. So, and also you're intersecting that education with the conservation, right, as well, because
yes.
you're training a lot of these students in conservation. And there's the Conservation South Luangwa that you partner with?
Conservation South Luangwa and Zambian Carnivore Program.
Right. So tell us a little bit about the status of poaching at this particular juncture. What kinds of successes that you and your partners have been able to achieve addressing this issue?
It's a lot to be said for that. It sort of, the focus of poaching changes depending on how easily people can get items in and out, what's happening with their own economy. So I'll just give one example right now. I would say the snare wire poaching is something that's pretty common throughout different countries in Africa as well as Asia. Looking to see if I had an example here in the room right now, but they'll take the wire. It could be wire from that was left over from a telephone company. It could be wire from a fence. It could be something like that, sort of different thickness for different animals. And they'll just, you know, very traditional, just loop the wire around, put it into a bush or something that is at the approximate level of where they think the animals would be walking through and catch their necks. The problem with that is that it catches everything, you know, indiscriminately. So it could be lions, it could be giraffe, it could be elephant, it could be antelope, it could be, you know, various, all sorts of different species. It is the silent killer around our world. And I will say, you know, I'm not excluding the U.S. for trapping.
Right,
you know,
right.
So I'll just add that in while we're...
Right, exactly. Also, because we're part of in some places still, I think there's part of the market, and the market can actually drive a lot of this.
Yeah. But I would say that, for example, for snare wires, there are scouts, and then they often also have some community groups that go out and will find the snares, take them out of the bush, saving so many animals. The animals that are caught in snares, hopefully they're seen by someone, reported, and then Conservation South Luangwa or Zambian Carnivore Program would go out with the veterinarian that we sponsor and locate the animal. And for elephants, it could be, or giraffe, it could be a extremely challenging situation, but eventually they will be able to sedate the animal, take off the wire snare, and then save that animal. And then when you look at the statistics of how many children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren that animal might have, it's pretty substantial when you're desnaring one particular animal. So that is an example of poaching. Reasons could be that people are wanting bushmeat is a big reason. It is illegal, but it could be that, or, you know, for subsistence, but it also could be that there's a bigger trade happening where they're then selling it and making a larger profit and that sort of thing. So, but that is one form of poaching.
Right. And so, but I was like, your tools, you have quite, so you have scouts, you're training scouts, and you have an airplane for surveillance, and you have a veterinarian on staff. So you have quite a bit of tools. So is there some success on your side in reducing?
Yeah. So I will just make sure that it's clarified for the bigger picture. We partner with, for example, for the airplane that we co-fund is shared by Conservation South Luangwa and Zambian Carnivore Program. We kicked off a helicopter program a couple of years ago, and that's also shared between the two. Scouts. So all of the projects that we support are actually either Conservation South Luangwa or Zambian Carnivore Programs, their actual projects and programs. And then we help fund those programs. So I would say we've had a little piece of success to be able to say we were a part of helping the success.
Right.
So I would say that because of our different programs that we have, we are definitely a piece of the puzzle that helps the success of the wildlife thriving in that area. Poaching going down, community awareness going up, and species, you know, increasing in population, so that's right.
Reviving, all good.
Yeah, exactly.
and so, like, I'll just, like, throw in a pitch here. Like, so, well, how would you, like, for the audience, for listeners, what can somebody else on the other side of the world do to, like, you know, support this?
Love that question. So I wore my hat, if people are listening and not seeing today, I wore my hat to do good, because I feel like we need, at this time in our lives, it's an all hands on deck. Everybody can do something. And I think that the awareness is one thing, but I feel like the actionable item after you are aware is so critically important. What can people do on the ground? One thing is be really conscientious about who you're voting for. And is it somebody that is going to protect the environment and wildlife? And I don't have apathy in this area. I will find somebody to vote for that has that. And it might not be perfect.
So take the time and do research and check out who your representatives are and how they stand on issues. And maybe if they don't, like, tell them how they could stand.
Yes, absolutely. Because it does make a difference. And like you just said, Michael, take the time to go meet with that person. You can call their office, schedule an appointment. If they know that we care about something or it's really important, they will be definitely more apt to vote in favor of the environment, for wildlife, for the health of all of us. The other thing that people can do is join hands with an organization. If there is something that you truly care about, pick an organization that you can give a little extra assistance to, a monthly donation, supporting with letter writing, leaving that organization in your will, even the smallest amount, even if it was $10 a month or $100 or $250, whatever it is that people want to do. Pick an organization. Nonprofits work so hard, and there's small ones, there's large ones. They're all working together in some way, typically behind the scenes or in front to help make a difference. And watch out who you shop for. I mean, it's just as conscientious. It's like, how are we living our daily lives? Because how we normally, we could shift a couple of things of who we vote for, what we're wearing, what we're choosing to buy or eat or whatever that might be, and how we're using our money to contribute. And it really like compounds and adds up. So I really encourage everyone to, you know, maybe stop for a moment and just think about what is one thing I could do today that would make our planet better, and start trying to do that consistently.
And I think if you're thinking, I've just thought of when you're thinking of wildlife, you can always contact your local zoo and find out who they're supporting and where they're, because there might be issues like banning ivory sale or things like that, petitions that can be signed.
Absolutely. Yeah. There are so many opportunities to do something good at this time in our lives. Like what a great opportunity, you know, for us to be on the planet right now to help make a difference.
Absolutely. Do good. So, and I should have asked you this in the beginning, but can you tell us what the name Dazzle means? Dazzle Africa?
Dazzle is a group of zebra.
Oh, okay.
And so it's funny. I lived in Las Vegas for a long time. Like I said earlier, I live in Kansas right now, but many of the co-founders were living in Las Vegas at the time. And so I think when we first started, people thought, oh, Dazzle, they're from Las Vegas, you know, and we're like, oh my gosh, no. But we just thought, you know, a dazzle is a group of zebra. It's dazzling. It's unique. Every stripe is different, you know, all of that theme.
All of that. Yes.
Yeah.
So, Stacey, I want to thank you for fostering this your stewardship and your whole program of providing these memorable experiences. Actually, and I was like listening to one of the reviews from one of your guests, and I just wanted to like add this in. It was like, she said, I don't think you can experience all of this without being changed in some way. We are all connected. There's no dividing line between us and the animals and the land. And I think that's a good description of like what you're doing on the ground. So I just wanted to thank you for that. And is there anything else you'd like to say about what you're doing, what you plan on doing in 2024?
Well, I will add in here that there's a few, not necessarily through our organization, but myself and a couple of other people are working on legislation for a full ban on elephant parts into the United States.
Excellent.
And if anybody happens to hear this, reach out to you. You could maybe shoot them back to me.
Okay.
But it would be a historic bill, and it would be the first time that elephants would not be allowed to have their parts traded, sold, bartered for in the United States. It would be excluding AZA zoos, but it would be in any kind of part of an elephant. People would be super surprised that in most states, if it hasn't already had a state bill like we did in Nevada, you can go down to your local boot store and buy elephant skin boots. So it's a huge problem. Skins and pieces of elephants are brought into the U.S. without a lot of fanfare. And so we are working on finding a champion actually for that bill right now. So if anybody listening has an idea of some congressperson who would like to champion that bill to bring it through, we are looking for that.
Well, I'm on board with that one. Absolutely. So I just wanted to finish up. And I always like to ask my guests if there's any other women that environmentalists or not, who inspire you?
Oh my gosh, so many. I mean, the list is long.
I love this part too.
I mean, truly, the list really is long. The one person that I work with closely is Rachel McCraub, who is a co-founder of Conservation South Lwangwa. And day in, day out, challenge after challenge, building up that organization over the past 20 years has made a absolutely massive difference in Zambia. And so I would say Rachel would be at the top of my list, but there are so, so, so many.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Stacey James, co-founder, CEO of Dazzle Africa. Your website is www.dazzleafrica.org. Go sign up for her newsletter, and we will post your links on our site.
Michael, you are the best. Thank you so much. And thank you for having such wonderful, wonderful people on your podcast and spreading the word for helping make everything better. So it's so appreciated. And again, it's an honor to be with you today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Stacy. Lovely to see you.
You too. Take care. Bye.
Bye. As we wrap up another enlightening episode of Environmental Voices Rising, Women at the Mic, we want to express our gratitude to our amazing guest and you, our dedicated listeners. Your support fuels our mission to amplify diverse voices of environmental innovation and provide you with inspirational stories of possibility and change on the path to a more sustainable, equitable future. Remember, it's through collective action and shared vision that we'll create a world that honors both people and planet. Keep exploring, keep advocating, and keep shaping tomorrow. Don't forget to visit our website for additional resources and consider making a donation to support our efforts. Thank you for being part of the journey, and until next time, let's keep striving for a better world.